This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww. Look, call me crazy, but I just think the guy going around and killing turtles would be the villain, not the protagonist.
I think you may have missed the point.
I just find it odd that if you care about animal conservation, the wholesale and gratuitous murder of innocent animals is a bit hard to stomach.
To be fair, the turtles are trying to kill him and his brother.
Yeah, but only if he walks right up to their face. Otherwise, they're just minding their own business and walking back and forth. He's the one stomping on them and kicking them into other turtles and bricks to gain coins for some reason.
Interesting take.
Look, cruelty against animals is wrong, even if you are trying to rescue a princess. Which raises the whole issue of whether trying to preserve an undemocratic monarchy is morally justifiable.
I don't disagree with you. I believe in democracy as long as my side wins. And also, I also believe in protecting animals. Well, protecting the doggos. The other animals can go screw themselves for all I care.
Fair enough.
How much of this antagonism is based on the fact that you were never actually able to finish Super Mario Brothers as a kid?
Who can say? Also,
ow! I think playing these video games is making you violent. Now, if there's one thing I've learned from watching the news recently is that the only way to respond to violence is with escalating levels of it. So, let's go! Show about medicine.
Batteries not included.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is
called... Wait. No, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body of... It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence, where you won't have to battle a giant ape, but you will have to face your own preconceptions and inherent biases when it comes to the medical literature.
And who can say which is the greater danger?
The ape. The ape is the greater danger.
That's true. A gorilla could rip a human in half.
That voice of sober realism is that of my co-host, Dr. Christopher Labos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and man who only likes video games if he can use a cheat code up, up, down, down, left, right, BA.
Life is about exploiting whatever advantages you can.
How very utilitarian.
And that voice of subtle criticism and condescension is my co-host Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who doesn't realize that in life, like in video games, winning is the only thing that matters.
Today, we will be staying clear of issues of moral philosophy, for the most part, and examining the question of whether violent video games are bad for us.
You mean if the controller from your Wii hits you in the face?
No, that's a very specific 2009 problem. Our focus today is going to be, if violent video games can cause aggression and violent behavior, especially in children. So we're not really going to get into the whole issue of screen time and sedentary behavior, which are important, but they are subjects that we have touched on before.
Although, as a brief recap, yeah, probably not a good thing to be playing video games for hours each day. Much better to do sports and other physical activities, especially for young kids.
Probably not much controversy there. Kids playing outside, joining sports teams, gives them much-needed exercise and exposes them to the social interactions they need to not turn into sociopaths later in life.
Ideally.
But our question is about violent behavior and aggression, which I realize are not quite the same thing, but we're casting a wide net. Now, I will say that I have read articles about this, and most of them have thoroughly, and I put in quotation marks, debunked the idea that violent video games make people violent. And it seems like this claim surrounding violent video games mostly comes from concerned parent groups that are motivated more by fear and emotion than by actual science.
So, interestingly enough, there has been research on this issue, and both the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Psychological Association have issued statements on this.
Oh, good. I love it when outside sources validate my preconceived expectations. Proceed.
So both groups have reviewed the evidence and concluded that violent video games are bad for children.
Well, that's just wild. because this is a standard talking point in the biz that violent video games don't make kids violent.
See, that's why you need me. I don't care about anything, so I come into every conversation genuinely apathetic as to its outcome.
You are an uncaring prince among men. But weren't laws banning the sales of video games struck down by the courts? I remember that vaguely.
Yes, they were. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, actually. It was Brown v. Entertainment Merchants Association. But the court case hinged on First Amendment issues, not on the quality of the science.
I see. That's vaguely disappointing. Like most things in life when you read about them for more than 5 minutes.
Now, there was a group of 82 scientists who filed what's called an amicus brief in the case. Their opinion was that the law had no value, or to be more accurate, that the evidence justifying its implementation was lacking.
I see. So they thought the link between video games and violence was too thin or non-existent.
Right.
But there are scientists who disagree with the official position of the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Psychological Association.
There are. Now, the focal point of this debate is a 2015 review by the APA, the American Psychological Association. And while there are other reviews and other studies, focusing on this one is important for a few reasons. It tends to be at the heart of a lot of the debates, and many of the issues here carry through to other studies too. So it's a good example of what we have to deal with.
So there are issues with the studies on violent video games then?
Well, there are. I mean, consider the issue of what makes a video game violent.
The presence of violence. Remind me to get you a dictionary for your birthday, preferably a print edition that I can smack you with.
Okay, but what constitutes violence? Is Super Mario Brothers violent?
You thought so 10 minutes ago.
Okay, but does cartoonish violence matter the same as realistic violence? Like, is Mario Kart as bad as Grand Theft Auto?
Hmm. You mean does the human brain intuitively separate out things that are unrealistic?
Right, and also video games have changed over time. They have much more of a narrative than they used to. There was basically no narrative to Space Invaders. It was shoot the aliens. But then you get Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers, where you have at least the thread of a plot as we move away from arcade games to console-based games. And you have the gradual evolution towards Assassin's Creed and the Batman Arkham series and Grand Theft Auto and all these other games.
And these games are much more photorealistic. There's an ingrained narrative where the quote-unquote hero does some morally ambiguous and sometimes very bad things. And conceivably, this could have much more of an effect than a game where you're stomping on turtles and eating magical flowers to throw fireballs at stuff.
Right.
Yeah, this could get complicated. And research from the 1980s and even the 1990s might not be that relevant anymore. Well, I guess you aren't totally useless, and it's a good thing I keep you around. Sorta.
That's it. Let's go! Ah! Ah!
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome back to The Body of Evidence, the show about data and science that only occasionally descends into violence and acrimonious name-calling.
You're a poo-poo head.
As are you, old chum, as Matt Berry might say. You know, today we are discussing violent video games and whether they cause aggressive behavior in children. And much to my surprise, many large medical organizations say that they do.
Although not everyone is in agreement.
Well, conflict makes for good entertainment, so let's dive in and explore the evidence. First off, I should say that I have trouble believing that any media, not just video games, could affect human behavior, Chris.
Although, think about it. I mean, it does. Ads, marketing, I mean, all kinds of things affect human behavior, so it's not inconceivable that violent imagery, especially realistic violent imagery, could have an impact.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but there's a difference between spurring people to buy things and causing violent and aggressive outbursts.
So, have you ever heard of the Bobo doll experiments?
You should safely assume that I have not.
Okay, so you know what a Bobo doll is, right? It's one of those inflatable things that keeps bouncing back when you push on it.
This isn't a sex toy thing, is it?
No. It's a doll with a low center of gravity on a round base. The physics of it are that you can push it over and then it immediately rights itself. They don't have to be inflatable, but the ones I know are these big inflatable things that you can knock over and they will stand back up again.
Okay, so they're kind of like punching bags that you can whack and it'll keep popping back up.
So that's some choice wording, because these toys were used in a series of experiments called the Bobo Doll Experiments that ran between 1961 and 1963, and they were designed to test social learning theory.
Which is the idea that behavior is learned, not ingrained. You aren't born bad. You learn to be bad because of X, Y, Z that happened to you early in life. Funnily enough, at the same time, Stanley Milgram was running his experiments on obedience to authority. And again, this idea of like, is it the situation or is it your personality that makes you do bad things?
Yeah. So the Bobo Doll experiments, what they basically did was they divided the kids into three groups. There was a control group for comparisons. There was an aggressive group and a non-aggressive group. And what happened was the kids were brought into a room filled with toys, but were told they couldn't play with them. Then an adult came in and played with the toys. For the aggressive group, the adult was violent with the Bobo Doll and would hit it and yell at it and knock it over. But with the non-aggressive group, he played calmly with the other toys and pretty much ignored the doll.
Is it okay to manipulate children like this for the purpose of science?
In the 1960s, it was.
It was indeed a simpler time.
Indeed. Anyway, after the initial exposure, the children were brought out of the room. Then they were given other toys to play with. And then those toys were taken away, you know, to build frustration.
Obviously, you gotta wind them up a little at first, clearly.
Yeah. And then they were brought back into the first room and told they could play with those toys now.
And what happened?
So the ones who witnessed the adult be violent with the Bobo doll were, unsurprisingly, violent with the Bobo doll. They beat that thing stupid.
Nice to see they were training a new generation of sociopaths.
Yeah, now, there were some follow-up studies to this.
Oh, good.
So the next iteration of the study was done with a live adult versus a video of an adult. And even the video of an adult was enough to boost the child's aggression.
I see. So even visual or, you know, video violence has an effect. I see why people extrapolate this to video games. I would argue that's not quite the same thing. Monkey see, monkey do. You know, they saw an adult knocking about a toy that frankly was designed to be knocked over and pop back up again. That's a far cry from taking a baseball bat and bludgeoning someone to death because you just played Mortal Kombat.
That's fair. Now, there was a third part to this experiment that is kind of relevant. In another study, the researchers did the same thing, but this time, after the adult was done beating up the Bobo doll, a researcher came in and either praised him and rewarded him with candy.
They were really trying to raise sociopaths, weren't they? Was this the Weapon X program that gave us Wolverine?
Unclear, but they compared this praise with punishment. So some children saw the adult be praised for beating on the doll, and some saw the actor be reprimanded.
And it made a difference?
Yeah, the children who saw the actor reprimanded were less likely to go to town on the doll with a malicious and uncontrollable rage.
So I can see a relevant parallel here with video games, because yes, you might be exposed to violent images, but if there was an external check to tell you this is wrong, you won't do it. And you don't get that in video games because games glorify the violence.
Yeah, and I mean, few video games reward thoughtful, introspective dialogue with your opponents.
Some do.
Yeah, it doesn't make for good gameplay. And it's particularly problematic for modern games where the protagonist is a very questionable person doing very questionable things. Think like Assassin's Creed, where the take-home message is to sneak up behind your enemies and slit their throats.
Yes.
Or Grand Theft Auto, where you're basically committing crimes.
Yes.
You know, violence was maybe less problematic in early video games like Contra, where, yeah, you're shooting people, but it's cartoon violence in a setting that barely makes sense. There's no real narrative. I mean, modern games have a real narrative.
But can't people tell fantasy from reality?
Well, young kids can't.
I guess not. Still, the Bobo study was a very artificial situation. It's a lab setting. They were exposed to the doll immediately afterwards. Would these effects have persisted for months afterwards?
Maybe not. And another thing is that when the studies were repeated later by different groups, a big thing was the novelty of the Bobo doll. You can imagine that a kid seeing this for the first time would be immediately curious to put it through the ringer. children who had played with one before were much less likely to beat it up, probably because once the novelty wears off, you're less likely to knock it about.
So all this was a very long digression to talk about social learning theory.
Right, and I think this is important because the notion that violent video games induce aggression isn't completely untenable. There is a basic concept that underlies it.
Okay, but let's actually examine the evidence on the issue of video games, not 1960s dolls. Like, what does the American Academy of Pediatrics actually say on this issue?
So it, quote, recognizes exposure to violence in media, including television, movies, music, and video games, as a significant risk to the health of children and adolescents, end quote.
Interesting that they refer to all media, not just video games.
True.
And what did they base this recommendation on?
Well, the main source of data and contention is the 2015 review by the American Psychological Association. They convened an expert panel to review the evidence and conduct a meta-analysis, which they did in 2010 and then updated in 2015.
So there's always a danger with meta-analyses that the quality of the studies you put into them determines the validity of the outcome. And I know that you're always a little bit wary about social science papers because the outcomes are not always as concrete as your unyielding and uncompromising brain will allow.
This is true. Now, they looked at a variety of outcomes. The first was aggressive behavior.
And how did they measure that?
Well, as you can imagine, aggressive behavior can mean many different things. It can go from pouring hot sauce on someone to blasting your radio.
Sorry, I was asking about aggressive behavior, not childish pranks.
And yet, these are the outcomes that are captured in their research. There were also outcomes based on questionnaires, teacher reports, and self-reports for things like pushing, hitting, and fighting.
Well, at least those last ones feel a bit more relevant. But overall, some of this feels pretty soft as far as outcomes go, like pouring hot sauce on someone, blasting your radio.
Look, I would tend to agree with you, but when When and if you accept this outcome for what it is, most of the published studies show an association between violent video games and aggressive behavior.
You mean mildly annoying and disruptive behavior.
True. Now, the review also looked at a different outcome called aggressive cognitions.
Which means?
It's a bit complicated, but basically hostile thoughts and feelings, aggressive intentions and attitudes.
Sure.
So there was more of that and less empathy with video games.
Okay. Are we objectively measuring empathy now?
In the social sciences, we are.
I thought you were going to tell me about violent crime, assault, murder, school dropouts, and stuff like that. Like, we need to turn this show into a true crime podcast, Chris, and this ain't cutting it.
I know. There is no data on any of those outcomes.
I feel like that's the more important stuff. These other outcomes are maybe interesting to psychologists, and maybe they matter, but not really what you need as a public policy person trying to make decisions, I would imagine.
Look, now, there are some caveats to all of this.
I'm bracing myself. Go ahead.
Most of this research is in teens and young adults. There's very little data for kids under 10.
Which is arguably the group most people are interested in, because I think most people are worried about negatively impacting impressionable children and are less concerned about guys playing Call of Duty in their college dorms. The phrase is always, think of the children, never think of Cody and Kumar at Stanford.
Which begs an interesting question. If you accept the general result of the meta-analysis that video games are associated with aggressive behavior,
I think you need to put big old air quotes around aggressive.
If you accept that at face value, some basic questions still remain. Does it hold true across all age groups? Are younger children at greater risk? Is it even ethical to do a study like this in young children? Is there a dose response? Does it get worse the more you play, or is any exposure bad?
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about how bad this is. Like, we need to quantify the increase in quote-unquote aggressive behavior.
Well, I can't.
Why not? And I swear, this better not be a teddy bear-related reason.
So, the studies can't provide a risk estimate, either relative or absolute, because most studies don't report outcomes that way. They report associations, correlations, or things like Cohen's d statistic.
You're going to have to explain what this is in 10 words or fewer.
So basically, it's the mean change divided by the standard deviation. It's useful mathematically, but not if you're trying to tell people video games increase school dropouts by 10 cases per thousand, for example.
But that would still give us a sense of how big of an effect we're talking about.
Yeah, I guess. And here's the... So the Cohen-D statistic was often less than one. So less than a standard deviation change, which is, you know, whatever.
The great Dr. Christopher Labos interprets a Cohen's D of less than one as whatever. I see why some researchers are somewhat dubious of the APA conclusion.
And there's also the issue of publication bias. As you can imagine, studies where violent video games have no effect on outcomes are not that interesting to the public or to journal editors, so the negative studies may not see the light of day. There are ways to adjust for publication bias statistically, but still, doubt remains.
I'm more confused now than at the beginning.
Then my work is done.
I mean, I started out doubting any of this because it seemed like parental hysteria, but thinking about it, I mean, exposing people to violent imagery, it's probably not really good for you in the long term.
If we learned anything from A Clockwork Orange, it was that.
But the data here is very inconclusive, and it uses outcomes that are not really what people care about. So how do we resolve this? I keep telling you people can't tell when you shrug. This is an audio-only platform.
Right. Here's the problem. There isn't a way to resolve this. Not until people do some larger studies in younger kids with more concrete endpoints. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
So would you let your young kids play violent video games? You know, if you ever know the touch of a woman and it leads to kids.
I don't think I would. As underwhelming as the evidence is, I think the general principle of violent imagery, especially realistic violent imagery, especially in games where there's a clear narrative that is very divergent from social norms and ethical values.
Like killing sex workers in Grand Theft Auto.
Exactly. I don't know if playing that game is bad for you, but I can for the life of me see how that's good for you. So to answer your question, no, I would not.
So do we need to say more research is needed?
No, let's say something a little bit more meaningful than that. The research to date is suggestive, but inconclusive and insufficient if you wanted to enact major policy change. I wouldn't let my kids play these games at a young age, but it's hard to make a blanket recommendation and pass laws to that effect.
But you'd be okay with Mario Kart, just not Grand Theft Auto.
Yes, I've decided that running someone off the road is okay if you're driving a giant banana and playing as a giant gorilla. That's cartoonish enough that I truly do think that even young kids would be able to distinguish that and distinguish fantasy from reality, and not have those effects carry forward into real life.
One hopes. What about adults? Any concerns about them playing violent video games?
Unclear. I mean, the evidence seems to correlate with more quote-unquote aggression, but is it going to make you more violent and lead to criminality? That's more dubious. I mean, we're a far cry from making that claim, and, you know, I don't want to start becoming the morality police, but at the same time, it's probably not a good thing to glorify violence. I mean, I don't see how that ends well.
And also, crime rates have gone down over time as video game use has gone up, so, you know... Maybe. Although people didn't start ramming their heads into brick walls to get more money after Super Mario Brothers came out, right? So maybe we'll be okay. Gamers can keep gaming, just maybe don't turn your back on them. So I guess the bottom line is we don't really know because the research is not very good. I feel like there's a way for gamers to remember that.
Violence and video games, not an easy topic to research. We don't know if they're really bad, really bad. We don't know if they're A-okay. We don't know if they're really bad, really bad. We don't know.
When we come back, journalist Jeff Wise published an article in Slate about how our early guesses about long COVID were way off the mark and echoing President Joe Biden's sentiment that COVID no longer controls our lives. Is he right? Is your personal risk of developing long COVID not as high as we once thought? That's after the break. Well, Welcome back to The Body of Evidence. And Chris, this episode of The Body of Evidence is brought to our listeners by the all-new Hippocrates Greens HG1 supplement. Did you know that Hippocrates, the father of medicine and all-around nice chap, once wrote to let dietary supplements be thy medicine? Well, no, actually he didn't. But did you also know that your diet of chicken wings and reheated pizza fails to provide you with the 340 essential nutrients for life?
I was shocked when I heard that for the first time.
I know. Well, that's what the copy says. That's why God made Hippocrates Greens HG1 for some reason, brown powder that you add to a cup of water and take a picture of for Instagram before chugging it down.
I've been drinking the free samples they sent us, and I have to say, I go to the bathroom at least three times more often than I used to.
We will get to that. Why gargle with a green smoothie that reminds you of the slime in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or a pink smoothie that reminds you of Pepto-Bismol?
Which probably is Pepto-Bismol, actually. that they're reselling to you in a different bottle.
When you could down a brown smoothie instead and stand out from the pack. HG1 supports gut health, Chris, meaning that your gut will have to process it after you drink it and crap out the inedible bits.
Remember to flush first before you wipe with the toilet paper, because the combination of the two can actually clog your toilet.
Yeah. It also contains chromium, which in any other food would freak you out as being a bad chemical, but because it's in our proprietary healthy beverage, you'll feel like you really need chromium in your life. Go to hippocratesgreens.ca.org.com and enter these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration at checkout to be put on some mailing list.
All one word.
Hippocrates Greens, because plain water is for chumps. In other news, I read an article about long COVID that after a quick read made me think, should I let my guard down a bit?
Yes, give in to complacency. Give in to the dark side of the force.
Yes. The article is called Long COVID Comes into the Light. It was written by Jeff Wise, published by Slate on March 19th. I sent it to you, Chris, to get your thoughts on it, and I also sought the opinions of other folks online. The gist of the article is that we thought COVID would be a mass disabling event due to a high prevalence of long COVID.
And to some extent, it has been. That's what we're discussing.
Yeah. And the idea also being that the symptoms of long COVID would not resolve for years. Mm-hmm. What Wise argues is that actually long COVID is not as common as we thought it might be, and that its symptoms resolve faster than we thought, so it's not as big a deal as we made it out to be. He does point out that some people do have debilitating symptoms from lingering illness, but it's not the catastrophe that we expected. I'm going to go over his arguments and then the pushback that the article received, including a letter asking Slate to retract the article.
Which will be as successful as the petition to remake the final season of Game of Thrones.
Though it would be less costly to do so.
Indeed.
We have discussed long COVID many times before on the show. It's usually from a public health perspective, which is great, but I want to look at it now from the perspective of personal risk, which I know is a self-centered lens, but I read the piece and I thought, okay, so how does it affect the risks that I take in my life?
How does this affect me specifically?
Me.
Forget everybody else.
Because, I mean, you know, look, to be honest, we all make this type of risk assessment, right? My biggest worry with COVID, it's not the acute infection, because the vaccines will probably help me avoid the worst outcomes. My biggest worry is long COVID. It's having brain fog for a year. It's being out of breath after walking up a single flight of stairs. That's my real concern. So with that personal risk perspective in mind, here are some of Wise's arguments. And we'll go through them one by one, and I'd love to hear your comments along the way.
If you pay me, you can hear my comments.
I will not pay you, and yet I will hear your comments. Argument number one, which is about the prevalence of long COVID. So he argues, look, we initially thought it would be one-third of all infections.
Right, which was probably high even then.
Yeah, this was based on surveys. Although, you know, new disease, you know, who knows?
The fundamental problem here is that every estimate has two major problems. Number one, we're probably simultaneously underestimating the true incidence of long COVID because most people are not recognizing the symptoms for what they are. So we're underestimating it on that end.
You told me in the past, like, some patients come to see you like, hey, doc, what's wrong with you? You're like, well, it sounds like some long COVID.
Yeah. It's like, I was perfectly fine. I got COVID and now I'm chronically short of breath. What do you think it is? And I'm like, well, I think it's the COVID. Just call me crazy, given that the temporality of that argument. And like, they've literally said that. And they're like, what do you think it is? I'm like, maybe it's the COVID. They're like, no, Right. Couldn't be that. I'm like,
so undercounting on one hand.
Undercounting on one hand. But then the other issue is that we don't have a lot of people who got infected with COVID were not diagnosed because they didn't have access to testing. They weren't officially mm-hmm. confirmed. So the denominator is smaller than what it should be, which then inflates the estimate of long COVID prevalence. On the one hand, you're underestimating it. On the other hand, you're overestimating it. And which of those two error factors is the more important one to, in which ways it's skewing it? And we don't really know. So I think every estimate has the potential to be inaccurate. On the whole, though, I think estimates saying that it was like, you know, 50% prevalence of long COVID were clearly overestimates, and even 30% is probably an overestimate. And when things have settled around the 10% issue, that seems about right from my anecdotal experience.
He's claiming that even that 11% figure from more recent surveys, and surveys are not perfect, is not borne out by more rigorously collected data. He quotes the Census Bureau's survey data, which shows the percentage of COVID patients who currently say they have long COVID. That percentage fell by 42% between June of last year and January of this year.
Yeah.
It is hard to know what the true percentage is.
And well, it's hard to know because there is no definition for long COVID, right? And again, it's a question.
It can affect so many different organ systems in your body. It can be as simple as I can't smell anymore, or I'm feeling a little bit tired to, you know, I can't get out of bed and I have complete brain fog. And that's one of his arguments, right? So it's not as prevalent as we thought it was, but we have to say, you know, the risk of long COVID is cumulative, right? Because each time you get infected by the virus, you're rolling the dice. And that's something that at the beginning, you know, a lot of people were making the argument for, well, once you've got COVID once, you'll never get it again. You have immunity for life.
Well, that turned out to be untrue.
Yeah, exactly. So each time you get COVID, you run the risk of developing long COVID.
Right. Well, because it's a virus. It's an infection. It's going to leave some degree of scarring behind, you know, scarring at the cellular level or biochemical level, but there's going to be an impact. You do not completely most people, when they get sick, are going to recover and be functional, but there is a little bit of deficit that remains behind. Even a minor stroke, even if you come out of it with no residual neurological issues and you're back to normal functioning, you know, some brain tissue died as a result of that stroke, probably. So there's a cumulative effect to these small micro strokes that, you know, cause a cumulative deficit over time.
Also, even if the percentage is 1%, 2%, 5%, a small percentage of a large number of people is a lot of people.
Yep.
And we had a similar problem with the mortality of the virus, right? Because it didn't kill half of everyone that it infected. Many people thought it was mild because they couldn't grasp that the low percentage was actual in actual numbers was a lot of people.
Yeah, because 7 million people died of COVID. That's a lot of people. And, you know, we weren't fighting the Nazis. So, you know, for 7 million people to die from one thing, that was significant.
Second argument is that symptoms blamed on COVID might actually arise from other things. Yeah. He mentions chronic comorbidities with onset of new symptoms or continuation of old ones. He mentions mood disorders and psychiatric symptoms that you would expect to find in a population that is undergoing the stress of a global pandemic. I think there's some validity to that. Of course, you are going to capture things that are not technically caused by long COVID.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that all of long COVID is not true. He mentioned that studies have compared COVID cohorts to flu cohorts to see if there are more residual symptoms in the one versus the other. And he claims that many studies show no real difference.
And again, it's this very difficult thing because, and especially in COVID, and especially the situation we have now in Canada, where it's very hard for people to access a family doctor, if you're going to use administrative databases for this, a lot of people are just not going to their doctor because they have mild symptoms and they're like, oh, I'm in worse shape than I used to be. I'm more short of breath because I haven't been exercising during the pandemic. I hear that a lot. And it's like, if you have less exercise capacity, there's a reason for it. It could be deconditioning, but if it started abruptly after a COVID infection, it's probably COVID. But people may not seek medical attention for that. And if they don't seek medical attention for that, you're going to underdiagnose it. So it's a very, very hard thing to assess because there's no test for it. There's no single, it's not like testing somebody for anemia. Either you're anemic or you're not. We can check the amount of hemoglobin in your blood. You can't test for long COVID. It's very much a gestalt. And it's also a question of, is your doctor willing to entertain that possibility? If you have a minimizing position, it's like, nah, you're fine, go away. You know, I ask people like, okay, you feel like this, like you're feeling palpitations. Did you catch COVID recently? And you'd be surprised how often the answer is yes. And they're like, so you think this could be the COVID? I'm like, it could be, you know, if you have no other alternative explanation, you do basic testing and you find nothing. You're like, well, common things being common, we're probably going to end up attributing this to COVID.
Third argument, most symptoms actually resolve within a year, not years plural.
Right.
What do you make of that?
I mean, that's probably true. That being said, I do have a few long-term patients who have suffered a lot. I have one very young patient. It's a poor girl. She has like this really bad, it's not a really bad arrhythmia in that it's not severe, but it's very symptomatic for her. Like she has a very, very fast heart rate as a result of COVID. It's a condition called inappropriate sinus tachycardia. And she was, you know, she was perfectly healthy. She got COVID, was really bad. I saw her. We did some, treated her a little bit. She was starting to get better. Got COVID a second time, got worse. And it's this, it's like, and she's not, you know, her life's not at risk. She's still going to school and seeing her friends, although her friends have now understood that she can't get COVID a third time. So they're now all careful and they all wear masks around her and the whole thing. So they're, she's living
for,
her life.
For now.
For now. But, you know, it's, and I think she also internalized that, okay, I can't get COVID. This is going to disrupt the equilibrium of my slow and steady improvement. So she's been at this for more than a year. She's, you know, certainly the rarer example of this. But, you know, most people have symptoms that last for months. That's true. But also think about what that means. Like today I wave a magic wand and you are too short of breath to exercise for the next 6 months. So from now until the fall of this year, you're basically not able to do the things you enjoy. Like, that's a big deal. Like, we talk about 6 months as if it's nothing. It's rough to
brain fog for 6 months, especially if your job relies on you thinking clearly.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. And of course, the article has nothing to say about the potential long-term damage of a COVID infection because it can't be measured yet.
No. And I know people, some of whom are friends, some of whom are spouses of some of my colleagues who were really sick with COVID and who were basically unable to walk upstairs for 6 months. Now, they eventually got better and they recovered, but for 6 months, they were literally too short of breath to walk upstairs. And that's a very scary thing to have happen to you. And
especially because you don't know when it's going to resolve.
That's right. Exactly.
Is this how the rest of my life is going to look like?
Well, and I see a similar thing post-cardiac surgery with patients, right? Because again, you tell them like, look, the recovery is going to be long. And they're like, no,
whatever.
I was told 5 days in a hospital and then I'm going to be home. And you're right. But you are chronically fatigued for like a good 3 months after surgery.
Wow.
And it gets slowly better. But you have to understand that you are not going to feel, there's an old saying, it's like you're going to feel okay by 1 month, you're going to feel well by 2 months, and you're going to feel back to normal at 3 months. So for a few months, like, you have to get ready for the fact that you're not going to be running upstairs. Like, it's not like TV where you're cured with the surgery. It's a whole season.
His last argument has to do with insurance data.
Yeah.
So he looked at the New York State Insurance Fund. It had several hundred successful claims after March, April 2020. Then it went down to less than 10 claims per month. It spiked into the double digits during, I'm guessing he meant Delta, he wrote Alpha and Omicron. March 2022, 5 claims for long COVID were being granted per month out of 3,000 disability claims in New York State. So basically he's saying, well, if it is such a mass disabling event, where are the insurance claims that are granted by insurance companies?
It's a question of people have access to doctors to actually get those things done. And as somebody who has to fill out insurance forms every once in a while, I can tell you they mean nothing.
Yeah. Also, I was reading that disability claims are not an accurate measure of disability in the U.S. The money is so small that people with disabilities might find a way to continue doing their work simply to earn enough money to live.
Yeah.
And also, apparently, applicants for Social Security benefits must meet impact tests that have little to do with long COVID symptoms or how it progresses. Insurers have little legal incentive under the law to pay claims out of court. Attorneys say many symptoms are subjective. They're only perceptible to a patient. So,
well, yeah, because if your symptoms are long COVID and you're like, can you sit at a computer and type? And if the answer is yes, you're like, well, you can do your job.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's not disability.
So the author, Jeff Wise, previously authored a piece in which he claimed that if only long COVID patients were opened to graded exercise therapy and to cognitive behavioral therapy, they'd be cured of their symptoms. Mm-hmm. And he was accused of only speaking to one long COVID patient and ignoring the evidence that this kind of exercise therapy can actually make things worse for a lot of long COVID patients.
Well, yeah, because you can't exercise, but you're just too short of breath. I mean, yes, you will recondition yourself slowly, but it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just go out and exercise.
So there's a letter asking for this Slate article to be retracted.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the accusations are cherry-picked data, biased sourcing, misinformed understanding of disability prevalence using successful insurance claims.
Yeah.
It excludes the perspective of credible experts. The organization of one of his sources even accused the reporter of misrepresenting information. A recent article, I believe it was in JAMA, reports that long COVID is an incredibly severe condition that affects at least 65 million people worldwide. He quotes an Israeli study that's been criticized, had many limitations, that likely presented an overly optimistic view of long COVID recovery. There was a study that found that 85% of long COVID patients, the vast majority, who had symptoms 2 months after infection, reported symptoms 1 year after onset. So this idea of a quick recovery might be overly optimistic. So let me ask you this as we wrap up. So based on all of this and based on what you know about long COVID, does that change your behavior? Are you willing to accept more risk into your life?
That is a very interesting question. And the answer is, I don't think so. Because even before, here's the thing, because I've been following the research, I think I sort of knew all of this already. Like, there was nothing surprising to me in this article. And I think the basic tenets of what he was trying to say are mostly true, in that the prevalence is not as high as some early reports suggested. Most symptoms are going to resolve in under a year or at the 1 year mark for most people. So I think that is basically true. But I think there is a substantial burden of disease here. And I know that because I have to see it, right? And I see a lot of patients who are like, you know, I can't exercise as much as I used to. Well, probably that was the COVID that did that, you know? So I haven't changed my behavior because I think I sort of understood the complexity and the nuance of this going in. Clearly, the risk of long COVID is going to decrease as the prevalence of COVID decreases overall, because you're less likely for each interaction to give you an infection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's complicated because at a certain point, we have to conform with society to some degree, because that's how society works, right? You can't, it's hard to be an outlier forever. I have the benefit, if you will. The funny thing to me is that wearing masks is completely normal, because I wear masks all day in a medical setting, which I don't think is going to change, frankly. Mm-hmm. There might be a few doctors who are like, I need to see my patient's face to have a good therapeutic relationship with them. Like, yeah, why don't you try picking up the phone when they call to build a therapeutic relationship? You know, how about you refill their medications instead of them going to the specialist to get their like blood pressure medication renewed? I feel like that's not an efficient use of my time. But, you know, so I think masks in the medical setting. So when like I wear my mask going around, it's like, yeah, but I'm doing this anyways. And I don't lose anything. Like, people don't need to see my nose when I'm buying cucumbers at the grocery store for that to be an emotionally fulfilling experience for me. You know, so I'm going to keep doing it for routine stuff. The question is going to become, you know, if there's an event and there's a meal at that event, are you going to sit in a room with 200 people eating a meal? And it's like, at a certain point, I guess, probably, but it's a tough thing. And so I haven't fully come up with a cohesive strategy yet, but I guess we're all slowly going to have to acclimatize to this new, very, very suboptimal reality we find ourselves in.
When we come back, is there a safer way of taking a biopsy of a prostate? The usual port of entry is the bum.
The bum.
But what if doctors aimed a little lower instead? That's after the break. Welcome to the final stretch of The Body of Evidence. We're going to talk about prostate biopsies. First off, when would a doctor want to do a prostate biopsy?
Basically for prostate cancer. That's really the only reason why you would want to do that, or the suspicion of prostate cancer to
get
a diagnosis.
Because your prostate-specific antigen in your blood is too high?
Yeah, essentially.
Okay.
It's usually because of that. Now, people often confuse an enlarged prostate with prostate cancer, and they're like, oh, I have an enlarged prostate to get that. Like, no, if you have an enlarged
prostate... prosthetic hypertrophy?
So some debate about whether we should call it hypertrophy or hyperplasia.
Okay.
And bonus points if you remember what the difference between those two is.
Hypertrophy is just larger.
Yeah.
And hyperplasia is there's more tissue than there used to be.
Sort of. So hypertrophy means the tissue gets thicker, but the number of cells is the same.
Right.
But hyperplasia means you have more cells
right.
that are dividing. Which sounds like cancer, but it's not.
Okay. Because it's benign.
So an enlarged prostate, which unfortunately happens with time, as men age because of testosterone. So the prostate does become bigger with time. And because of the anatomy of the prostate wrapped around the urethra for some inexplicable reason, means that it's harder for the bladder to empty. So you have what are called lower urinary tract symptoms. So you have obstructive symptoms. So it's like you can't empty the bladder. It's harder. It's not that it's harder to pee. It's harder to empty the bladder. So you end up going more frequently.
So you end
up waking up multiple times in the middle of the night to empty your bladder. Funny side, I had a patient who was like, doctor, I know this isn't your thing, but can you prescribe me sleeping pills? I'm like, I really don't want to. I don't, you know, sleeping pills are bad. He's like, and it says, like, why do you need sleeping pills? He's like, I can't sleep at night. I go, why can't you sleep at night? He's like, I wake up multiple times. And I'm like, why?
It's a doctor to the bathroom. Moment.
He goes, because I have to go to the bathroom like multiple
Tell
times.
Tell me more.
And I was like, well, sir, you realize what you're describing is an enlarged prostate. It's not insomnia. You have benign prostate. And he was like, oh, yeah, okay, I see what you're getting at there. I'm like, you need Flomax or something similar to.
So for people who argue that medicine doesn't treat the underlying condition but only treats the symptoms, this is exactly an opposite, an example of the exact opposite.
Yeah,
like somebody just wants the symptom to be treated. And you're like, no, there's an underlying
condition.
There's
an underlying reason here. And I had to convince him that that was the case. Even he's literally telling me, I wake up to go pee. And I was like, but you realize that's the issue, not the insomnia.
Yeah.
You realize if I give you sleeping pills, you're just going to like wet the bed because right. you won't wake up. Anyways, so an enlarged prostate doesn't require interventions of any kind or a biopsy. You get a biopsy because usually the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, is elevated on blood tests and cancer screening, or in the days when people did rectal examinations of the prostate, which are not done that much anymore, really, you would feel a nodule and you're like, okay, I have to get a biopsy to see what's going on.
And that would be the pathologist looking at tissue from the biopsy.
Yes.
And looking at the tissue under a microscope. So how does
to give you a Gleason score? Basically, what
yes,
they would
I
do
remember
is
that.
They would usually take 10 samples.
Mm-hmm.
10 samples? No, 5 samples, and then there was a score between 0 and 2 for each of them, and so they would sum up to a thing of 10, and based on what the final score was, you would make a decision about how aggressive that cancer appeared to be.
Okay, I remember hearing about the Gleason score. I didn't remember how it was calculated.
Yeah.
So you need to take a biopsy. So how does one traditionally take a sample of someone's prostate?
So it's a transrectal biopsy. So basically what you do is, because of the way the prostate is located anatomically, the easiest way to access it is through the rectum, because it's very posterior. Uh-huh. That's right. So what you do is you bend over, sir. Yeah. You stick a probe into the rectum, usually with ultrasound guidance. And so you would have a needle that would then shoot out from the device through the wall of the rectum into the prostate, grab a sample, bring it back, and then you would do that multiple times to get the 5 samples. Yeah.
You do this multiple times.
Well, because you need to get the 5 different samples.
Right.
Because the problem with it, because you are a little bit blind, you want to get multiple samples just in case you miss the nodule that you were trying to get.
Right.
So that's why the Gleason score is like a composite of all the samples.
Mm-hmm.
Because if some samples are normal, but some samples show cancer, if one out of the samples show cancer and the others didn't, then that's probably a fairly not aggressive cancer. Whereas if all of them showed cancer, then it's a much more aggressive cancer.
Okay, so I was going to ask, are there problems with this approach? I mean, obviously the idea of sticking something up there and then sticking multiple needles in there, that doesn't sound like fun.
Yeah.
But are there like complications or problems with this particular approach?
It's infection, because when the needle is going from the rectum into the bladder, you're introducing all the bacteria in your rectum into your bladder. And so urinary tract infections are very common. So you have to treat people. You basically have to give them antibiotics. Otherwise, there will be an infection.
Prophylactically.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's expensive when you think of it from the population level. There are risks to antibiotics, obviously. They contribute to antibiotic resistance.
Yep.
And there's the risk of causing a severe infection. It's also painful, right? It does hurt. And I mean, it's not a dangerous procedure, like it's not under general anesthesia or anything, but you know, it is a procedure. You have to go to the hospital. So there are certainly complications associated with it. And the use of antibiotics is obviously something that is problematic. The other issue with it, because of how you're getting it, you're only getting samples from the posterior surface of the prostate. So remember, the prostate is a three-dimensional organ. You're not sampling a significant portion of it. So you can miss stuff if the tumor just happens to be located on the anterior surface that you just can't access.
So what's the solution, Chris?
Panic. No. So the solution is, I have recently learned that there is a newer technique that is being talked about and debated, which is called a perineal biopsy. So basically, you go to your perineum, which is the section of skin below your genitals, but above your anus.
What is commonly referred to as the taint.
The taint. Which I didn't know until you told me. I'd never heard that word
really?
Before. I'd never heard that word before.
Because it ain't the this and it ain't the that.
I see. So you're basically, I mean, you know where the prostate is. It's just under their bladder. Basically, instead of doing this approach, which is instead of doing the transrectal approach, which is essentially a non-invasive, it's a non-surgical approach. This is a surgical approach. You're making a small incision. You're going in there, getting a sample of the biopsy, getting a sample of the prostate, and taking it out for microscopic examination. So you're doing the same thing.
Are you able to take samples from like the entirety of the prostate, or are you still stuck with just this one, the one side that you have access to?
Well, no, that's the advantage in that because you usually couple this with an MRI that you've done beforehand, you know where the tumor or the unclear thing is, so you can go to that area. So in the same way that, let's say you were doing a lumpectomy if a woman had breast cancer, you know where the tumor is, you're doing a minimally invasive incision to get at it. It's just that, you know, the breast cancer thing is easier because it's an external structure, so you can get to it much more easily. Whereas with this, you really have to go deep. But the thinking is now you're transitioning to this alternative way of getting to the prostate.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of this approach?
Well, the advantages are you don't need to give the patient prophylactic antibiotics because you can just, you know, like with surgery. I mean, different surgeries sometimes require antibiotics, but here you can just basically clean the surface of the skin, sterilize it, use a sterile technique, and so you don't need to give antibiotics, so you save that way. The risk of introducing infection is much, much less. But it is an incision, so, you know, it has to be done in a surgical suite. And there is some debate in the literature, from what I can see, about whether it should be done under general anesthesia or under local anesthesia. Because obviously general anesthesia is a lot more complicated, a lot more risky.
Mm-hmm.
If you could do it under local anesthesia, that would save a lot of money, save a lot of complications, and save a lot of hassle. So that's the advantages. You're getting a better sample. You're avoiding antibiotics, but it is a, you know, slightly more invasive surgical technique. But it's interesting that there seems to be at least a discussion in the urology circles to move that way, potentially more so in Europe than here, but that does seem to be the way things are shifting.
What we need are the transporters from Star Trek, right? So you just go, just transport out a little bit of the prostate and you send it to pathology.
The problem, and it's sometimes very interesting to compare prostate cancer with breast cancer, because in many ways, a lot of the same issues come up. But what has befuddled prostate cancer treatment and surgery is the fact that it's a very difficult organ to access because just the surgical intervention can damage many of the perineal nerves, which lead to issues like urinary retention, erectile dysfunction, impotence, that's there. Whereas breast cancer, now that surgical techniques have improved to the point where you can just do a lumpectomy, so you've avoided the radical mastectomies of years past.
You remove the lump, not the entire breast.
Exactly. I mean, it's done. The women are awake when they go for this. Like, they're talking.
Wow.
So you go local freezing, you remove the thing, it's done.
Wow.
It's a day procedure.
Okay.
So it's, and you know, the radiation has improved, the chemotherapy has improved. I mean, we have tamoxifen, which has like no side effects really. So
In large part, because it is an external
structure. It's an external organ, so the surgery is a much less thing. If you need to, people will accuse, the thing about breast cancer is overdiagnosis, right? We're treating these minor things that we could leave them alone, yes, but it's so easy to treat them that the feeling is let's overtreat it. The issue with prostate cancer is like, do we treat prostate cancer or do we do watchful waiting? And the thing with watchful waiting is, I get it, but it's largely because the risk of intervening is so hard. So if we could get better at the interventions and develop much more minimally invasive techniques, you might see thinking on this issue shift much more towards an interventionist frame of mind.
It's now time for our second favorite segment. Mm-hmm. It's not Twitter, but it'll do, where we share things we would normally share on that social media platform that is slowly coming apart at the seams. I was interviewed by Adrian Hill on the podcast The Skeptic Zone, and we covered a number of topics, how I got into science and into science communication, the flaws in scientific research, the concept of drive-by skepticism, problems with movement skepticism, how to get critical thinking into schools, the Hawthorne effect. There's even a quote from this podcast, Chris. Ooh. You got to mention. So you can listen to the full 25-minute interview on YouTube, link in the show notes. I also recently wrote about a disturbing forensic science called 911 call analysis. The idea is that cops are being taught to pick up on cues in the 911 call to know if the caller is actually the criminal trying to get away with murder.
And criminals usually call 911 on themselves?
Well, not on themselves, but in the sense that if you just killed somebody and the body is in your apartment or your house, you have to do something with it.
Oh, I see.
And so they might go, well, I'll just call 911 and say that there was an accident it's a suicide, whatever.
I see.
But the problem is that this 911 call analysis is based on a tiny sample and a methodologically questionable paper. What I found interesting is that a lot of the coverage exposing this particular technique said that studies failed to replicate the original findings, which is not quite true. Mm-hmm. The replication results were really all over the place. Some seemed to validate the original findings. Others went in the opposite direction. All these replications were they were too small to be meaningful.
So basically, crime analysis is not like an episode of Columbo where you know who did it right at the beginning.
No, it's not.
I see. That's vaguely disappointing.
And one more thing. Mm. Chris, what about you? What do you have to tweet about?
What you wrote here is very accurate.
I know. Can you read it out?
It sure says, blah, what did I do? I don't know. I don't care. That's accurate. I'm like a shark. I can only swim forward. I can't think what happened last week. It's like, that's not how my brain works. I did stuff. I don't know. I did stuff.
Did you do any kind of interview that was outside the norm?
What does norm mean? I don't know.
Like, well, you're always on CTV. Yeah, you're always on CBC. Like, was there something outside of that? Like a one-shot
thing? I did an interview. Well, I don't know if people are going to see it. Like, there was the student who emailed us who from...
Which one?
That's Minnesota? No.
Minnesota.
Somewhere in the central time zone. She was from Sage Academy. She was from Sage Academy. Yeah. No, she didn't talk like that, actually. Anyways, it was a high school student. She was doing a project on cell phones.
Oh, okay.
And she was the one who emailed the podcast and you texted me about it. Yeah. Anyway, so she wanted to like go over the evidence for, you know, screen time and kids and whatever. So
I see.
Kind of somewhat timely because we were just prepping for this episode. Yeah. And so I did the thing with her. But I think that's just for her school projects. I don't think anybody will actually see it.
Right.
I mean, I did a few extra segments with CBC on the weekend, which are always sort of like ad hoc things about erythritol, which is, you know, the artificial sweetener that we talked about. And then we talked about, I did a few syndication runs for the CBC about this new fungus in the U.S., Candida auris, which, probably should have been a segment now that I think about it.
Okay. In 1 minute, is it linked to The Last of Us? Because ever since The Last of Us came out, everybody's talking about fungi.
Yeah, but this has been happening for a few years. But there is a new Candida fungus in the U.S., Candida auris, which is resistant to many of the classic antifungal agents. And its incidence has been going up year on year as we screen for it. So there's a concern for that.
So the zombie apocalypse is
indeed,
coming.
Indeed. What's fast? Have you seen The Last of Us?
No.
the opening scene, which you can find on the internet, is basically a talk show with this professor talking about, you know, we need to be really careful about fungi because, you know, they can like infect their host but make their host super strong because they make penicillin. They can control their host because we get LSD from fungus, so they can like manipulate our base. So he's trying to like set the stage for why The Last of Us could happen. But he's like, the only thing that's saving us is that a fungus can survive within a human being. And I'm like, of course it can. Fungal infections are very common all the time. So people are talking about it. The Last of Us is not very scientific. Like a lot of that early segment is not actually true because of course the fungus can survive in the human body. And his whole thing was like, right now they can't survive at high temperatures, but if global warming were to get worse, then maybe it would evolve the capacity to survive in humans and it would infect us and at the same time control our brains but make us super strong. And I'm like, no, a fungal infection is just gonna cause sepsis and kill you. So
but that wouldn't make for a very entertaining video game or TV series.
No, it would just mean more people getting hospital-acquired infections, which is essentially what's happening. So I did a whole syndication run on that. Oh, this morning, actually.
Pedro Pascal with a UTI is not primetime television.
That's right. Yeah, I did the syndication run for that this morning.
Okay.
Actually, so.
Good for you.
Yeah.
We want to thank our newest patrons, Julie Butler, Victor Anderson, Karen Davey, Kathy Tuzinski, and Reed O'Neill. We want to thank Ian for his regular PayPal contribution, and we want to thank all of our patrons, but especially those at the $5 or more level, and they are Alan, Barb, Bill, Brian and Terry, Christopher, Corey, D, Dan, Dave Lansing, DJA, Don, L, Frank, Jeff, Grace, Hired Goon, Isabel, Islan, Jean-Nicolas, Jeff, Joanne, John, Juan, Julie, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Leanne, Leon, Leslie, Louise, Luna, Lindsay, Marianne, Mark, Mary, Mavis, Miriam, Ms. Bean, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Rina, Robin, Ronald, Rye, Sky, That Montreal Guy, Trimian, and Warren. If you want to help support our show, go to bodyofevidence.ca/about and you will see two options. You can make a donation through PayPal or you can become a patron on Patreon, either making monthly contributions or an annual contribution. When you become a patron for as little as $1 a month, you get access to a patron-only bonus segment each month called Digressions, and this month's Digressions will be on...
We're going to be answering questions about this episode, this topic, and also talking about penicillin allergy delisting. How to remove an allergy diagnosis from your medical file if you think you might have one.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Jillian Correa of the Virtual Music School Rocktavio Canada. Check the show notes for full music credits. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the
body of evidence.
Topic to research. We don't know if they're really bad, really bad. We don't know if they're A-okay. We don't know if they're really bad, really bad. We don't know.